STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Well, the show is Stand to Reason, and I am Jay Warren Wallace, sitting in for Greg Kokel. Is that like really Coolio kind of music? I like that. That's new. I'm not even sure I can do the show not knowing. I've never heard that music before, but I think it's pretty cool. Anyway, Jay Warren Wallace sitting in here for Greg. And Greg, you know, whenever he travels or he happens to be away on a speaking engagement or whatever, I feel so blessed to be able to get a chance to come in and sit in this chair and just share with you and talk to you about the things that matter most in life, right? Ethics, values, religion. That's what we do here at Stand to Reason. It's clear thinking Christianity and basic training for your mind. Now, I'm going to start by hopefully giving you some basic training for your mind on a very specific issue, and that hopefully will give you time to call us at 855-243-9975 and get on the conversation, and let's see if we can hash through the issues together. So get on the line right now at 855-243-9975, and in the meantime, I'm going to try to train you up in an area that I think is so helpful, and we don't often do this. Look, it's a book I just wrote called Forensic Faith, and in one of the categories, one of the sections of the book, we're talking about how to convincingly communicate the case for Christianity to others. And sometimes when we talk about that, you know, it's really easy to get into tactics, and Greg has done a masterful job of tactics, so I'm not going to come in and talk about the same things. Instead, I want to come alongside that conversation and give you another skill set that, if you are using a tactical approach, might also help you to communicate truth claims. Because this is what we do, right, as first responders, as detectives. My whole life has been, number one, to accept that duty and what my responsibilities are, to train to be better at it, to learn how to investigate claims, and then learn how to communicate what I've learned about a suspect, about a crime. How do I communicate that to a prosecutor in such a way that he can then envision how it might be communicated to a jury and be willing to file the case to begin with? So a lot of this is about learning how to become an effective communicator. And when I talk about this in the book, and I talk about this at public speaking events, I have a tendency, rather than to give you, you know, approaches about how you might dress or what kind of gestures you might make with your hand. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I want to go to a deeper, to a more foundational issue. Before you can even begin to communicate what you believe to others as a Christian, you're going to have to pick the right group in which to make the case to begin with. We don't just, you know, start off willy-nilly making cases. We have a jury that we impanel first, and selecting the right jury is key to our communication. I've talked about that before on my show. I've talked about that here. But if you don't pick the right jury, your efforts are going to be wasted. Because jurors are on a spectrum of bias, a spectrum of a continuum, basically, from those who would be willing to accept your message no matter who you are to those who would always reject your message no matter who you are. And you don't want people on the extremes. We're looking for people in the middle of the spectrum, people who would be open to hearing what you have to say. But aside from that, even that's what we do. By the way, we do that before we begin presenting a case, before you ever make an opening statement in a trial. Before you spend weeks presenting the evidence in a trial, before the closing argument, the rebuttal, any of that is jury selection. Without the right jury, you don't win cases. But there's something else, another bit of a mystery here, and that is in the way that we prepare a jury to hear the case. We don't put the case in front of the jury without first teaching them some basic rules of evidence, so that they will understand what the rules are as they make a decision, as they assess the evidence. They will understand what the rules are. Because if you don't understand the rules, I can make a case and you won't understand what relationships should be, or what counts, what doesn't count, what things are helpful, what things aren't. So I'm going to just share with you in this first opening minutes of the show, as you call us at 855-243-9975, I'm going to share with you some basic rules of evidence that if you were to spend some time understanding these rules and then communicating these rules to the people you're trying to talk about Christianity with, it would condition them to understand just how strong the case is. We don't often do this. We don't often spend time, kind of pre-evangelizing in this way where we help people understand how to think reasonably before we offer a reasonable case. But if we did that, I think we'd have much greater success. So let me give you a couple of basic, simple rules. I do a talk where I do 10 of these, 10 rules of evidence. I just want to give you a few. First of all, we have to help people understand that there are only two categories of evidence. I've said it before. It's direct evidence and indirect evidence. Every case made in front of a jury is made with only these two forms of evidence. And direct evidence is exclusively eyewitness testimony. If you don't have somebody who saw the crime and can identify who did it, you don't have a direct evidence case. You have an indirect evidence case. Well, DNA, that's indirect evidence. Fingerprints, indirect evidence. Material evidences, indirect evidence. Behaviors exhibited by the suspect, indirect evidence. The only form of direct evidence is an eyewitness who can testify to what happened. Now, the other word for indirect evidence is circumstantial evidence. And we have to help people understand that a circumstantial case is every bit as valid as a direct evidence case. Because they'll typically say, well, look, you don't have a case for God you can make with direct evidence. Well, yeah, no doubt. There's no one here who can, well, at least in a sense, can say they were there to see God create the universe. Now, people can offer that they've seen God working in their lives, but everyone pretty much of every theistic worldview will say something similar to that. So how do we make a case for God's existence? Well, I would make it with indirect evidence. But by the way, judges instruct jurors in jury trials to treat indirect evidence with the exact same value they treat direct evidence. Now, we typically hear in the culture people say things like, oh, all they have is a circumstantial case, or that's just a circumstantial case. Well, really? The jury instruction for jurors is pretty straightforward. It says, this is it from California, it sounds exactly like this. Judges tell juries both direct and circumstantial evidence are acceptable types of evidence, and neither, hear me, is entitled to any greater weight than the other. So you really can't say it's just a circumstantial case unless you're willing to say it's just a direct evidence case, because these are to be treated with the exact same value, the exact same weight. Help the people you're talking to about the Christian worldview, about the case for God's existence, to understand that it's entirely legitimate to make the case on the basis of indirect evidence. I make it on 8 pieces of evidence in God's crime scene, right? The origin of the universe, the fine-tuning in the universe, the appearance of life in the universe, the appearance of design in life in the universe, the existence of consciousness and free agency, of objective transcendent moral truths, and even the standard of good by which we would call something evil. These are pieces of evidence in the universe that are entirely legitimate to use in trying to discover the first cause. What is the best causal explanation for these 8 pieces? Now, yes, we don't have an eyewitness for this, but you don't need one. And in my cases, as a cold case detective, I have never had a direct evidence case. Because remember, cold cases are unsolved cases from the past, and they're unsolved for a reason. There weren't eyewitnesses most of the time. So we have a case, and we have to make it indirectly. We've never lost a case, and these are entirely indirect, entirely circumstantial. Let me give you another simple thing that I talk about a lot. That is the difference. This is another jury instruction. We actually instruct jurors in this area also, that there's a difference between what's possible and what's reasonable. The standard of proof is not beyond a possible doubt, because you could never eliminate all possible doubts. And I can always lodge and offer another possible doubt for any claim you might make. The standard is actually lower. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. And you might say, well, is that high enough? Don't I need 100% certainty, like in a scientific experiment? I got to reach 100% before I can make a decision. Really? So what do you think it is in your life that you've made a decision about for which you have 100% certainty? There's nothing. I always put it this way. Anything and everything is possible, but not everything and anything is reasonable. Now, some people will use the possible plausible dichotomy, which is fine because it alliterates pretty nicely, right? Anything is possible, but not everything is plausible. I get that; it sounds good. But in criminal trials, it's not beyond a plausible doubt; it's beyond a reasonable doubt. So I try to keep that distinction: possible, reasonable. Now, that's helpful because what we're really trying to get at is this level of certainty we call beyond a reasonable doubt, which means that we could arrive there simply by looking at every possible explanation for a cause, every possible explanation for a claim, like the claim of the resurrection or the claim of what was the first cause of the universe. We could look at every possible explanation offered by those who don't believe or do believe and simply rule out those and arrive at the one most reasonable. Now, you could still say, well, Jim, it doesn't mean that that's actually – okay, I get it. You don't have to have 100% certainty on it. But of all the possible explanations, we always will gravitate toward the more reasonable one, and that's actually a reasonable approach. So that's actually a standard we could embrace if we use that and explain that this is what is used in every criminal trial. For the most egregious crimes committed in America, the highest level that's required is only beyond a reasonable doubt. Right? And so for us, this is, I think, a standard that is applicable as well. And remember, here's my third rule, that every case has unanswered questions. Everyone does. I mean, I've got cases I can point to in my own career that I've been on Dateline. I've been on Dateline on several of these in which we had huge, gaping, unanswered questions that the jurors were never going to have answered before we were going to ask them to make a decision. As a matter of fact, when we placed those jurors on the jury, we asked them during the voir dire process, are you the kind of person who has to have every question answered before you can make a decision? And if someone says, yeah, I think that is... You know, that is my position. My position is I have to have every question answered. I can't have any doubts. Well, then you're excused. You can't be on the jury because there's never been a trial I've ever been involved with in which I could answer every question. That just isn't the way it works. And by the way, every worldview is similar to this. Not as an atheist, I had several unanswered questions, right? I couldn't answer the questions for those eight pieces of evidence I just listed for you. Yet I still held on to that view, even though I had huge unanswered. I just think there are less unanswered questions, less unanswerable questions in the under the Christian worldview than there are under other worldviews. Now, I will tell you that there is a jury instruction for this too. And here it is. It's from the CalCrim jury instructions in California, the criminal jury instructions, number 103 is, the evidence need not eliminate all possible doubt because everything in life is open to some possible or imaginary doubt. That is a jury instruction. So we tell people all the time, if you think you're going to eliminate every possible doubt, you're not going to make a decision about anything. It's anything is possible. It's possible you could go out to your car tomorrow morning, sit in the driveway, put the key in the ignition, and it'll blow up in your face. It happens every day all over America. But it's probably not going to happen to you. And so you're going to operate under what's reasonable, if you were thinking about everything that was possible, you wouldn't go out of the house. I also want to say that something that people need to hear, especially for Christians who are trying to argue for the reliability of the New Testament, this fourth jury instruction, this fourth rule of evidence, and that's this. Witnesses never agree, and the order in which they testify matters, and it can sometimes explain the disagreement. Hear me. Witnesses never agree. I've never had a criminal trial, a case I've ever worked, in which I got witnesses to agree. Do you realize that there's only one request I make as an investigator when I'm called out at 2 o'clock in the morning? Only one. I'm rolling out of bed. I got to put a suit on. It's going to be a while before I can get to the crime scene. I'm talking to the dispatcher. She's saying, hey, we got a call out. I need you at this address. You'll be talking to Sergeant so-and-so on scene at the time. I always say, well, are officers still on the scene? That's the one question I ask. Are officers still on the scene? Has he got other officers with him? And they're going to say yes, 9 times out of 10. And I'm going to have one instruction for those officers. Have them separate the eyewitnesses. That's it. That's my only instruction before leaving the house on a call out, is have officers on the scene separate eyewitnesses. You know why? Because if you don't separate the eyewitnesses, they're all going to agree because they've had an hour to sit around and talk about it with each other. And the one thing I don't want my witnesses to do is to come to agreement before I get there. No, there'll be differences. These won't necessarily be contradictions. They'll simply be differences in the accounts that I will be able to reconcile on my own without having them try to reconcile it for me. Because if that's the case, they're going to forego some important piece of data that they're not going to think is important to me. It might be important to me. No, I want to hear it all. Let me give you an example of how this might look, okay? We've got time to do this before I break here. The first witness, you get there, and he's at a robbery scene, and so the first witness might say something like, okay, yeah, he wore a white T-shirt and jeans, and his hair was short, and he yelled a lot. Okay. Now, what is she trying to answer? That first witness is trying to answer, well, what did he wear? What did he look like? What did he say? She says, he wore a white T-shirt and jeans. His hair was short. He yelled a lot. Now, I go to the next witness. And by the way, these witnesses have been separated, so I am getting them one at a time, and they're not able to hear what the other witness is saying. That's important. Next witness comes in. Same questions. What was he wearing? What did he look like? And what did he say? And this person says, well, he wore a T-shirt and jeans. His hair was blonde. He demanded money. Okay, now he's still answering the same questions, but you'll notice he's giving me slightly different. He didn't say the T-shirt was white like the first one did. And the first one said the hair was short. This guy doesn't say that at all. It just says the hair was blonde. And the first one said, well, he yelled a lot. But this one says, well, he demanded money. But still, he's trying to answer the same three questions the first one did. And there is the level of difference I would expect from two separate witnesses who might have a background that would cause them to focus on different things. The third one comes up. He says, yeah, he wore a short sleeve shirt and jeans. He was a white guy. And he screamed at the clerk. Okay, well, this is now the same data, answering the same questions. What did he wear? What did he look like? What did he say? But you'll notice now this guy is offering a racial description for the first time. Nobody else did that. Why is this guy doing that? And now he's saying he screamed at the clerk. No one else ever directed that where that scream was directed. But this is the level of difference I would see between eyewitness testimony. Now imagine for a second that there might be a fourth witness who is standing alongside this, and I don't even know he's a witness, and he's been overhearing the testimony, the conversations, my interviews with the first three witnesses. That would be a terrible scenario. I would never want that. But occasionally it does happen where someone is not quickly identified as a witness, and he's standing there overhearing the other witness claims. He now walks up, and when asked, well, okay, what did you see? Or what do you know about this? This guy says, well, he's a regular customer, you know? And afterwards, he ran out to a white van. Whoa, 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 whoa. That's interesting. That's pretty interesting. The first three are answering the question, what did he wear? What did he look like? And what did he say? Now, this guy's not answering those questions at all. He's answering who he was. You know, who is this guy? Well, he's a regular customer. And what did he do after the crime? Well, these are two completely new categories that no one else has described before. Why is this guy offering me two new categories? Well, if you ask him, he'll tell you because he overheard what the other three said. They've already covered this. He's now going to come in and add some new detail that you didn't know before. And he's doing that because he's aware of what the first three already said. I have to stop this guy and say, dude, back up. Pretend like you didn't know what they said. I want you just to cover it from the beginning to the end because I don't want him to fill in the details because he knows what they said. I want him to give it to me from the beginning to the end again because if he's just filling in details, I would expect him to add in data that's missing from the other three. Now, does something similar happen in Scripture? I think so. If, for example, we were just to look at the event called the Lord's Supper, all four accounts describe this event. So, for example, Mark comes along when describing it. He says, okay, as they were reclining at the table and eating, Jesus said, truly I say to you that one of you will betray me. Okay, fine. This author is clearly arguing or providing data on two key questions. Where were they and what did Jesus say? Interestingly, there's another account out there, Matthew, that also answers those two questions in a slightly different way. He says, as they were eating, he, meaning Jesus, said, truly I say to you that one of you will betray me. Covering the same stuff. He's covering the same two questions. Where were they? What did Jesus say? But it's slightly different. Is there a conflict here? Is one telling me the truth and one? No, they're both telling me the truth, but they're coming at it from slightly different perspectives. Third author, Luke. Luke comes along, and his sources put it this way. But behold, the hand of the one betraying me is with mine on the table. A slightly different statement. Is somebody lying? No, these are slightly different, very exactly what I expect to see, exactly what I see in criminal trials, exactly what I see with every set of eyewitnesses. Now, what if there's somebody who's standing in the wings, who's hearing the testimony of the first three, and is now going to come in and describe the same scene? There is someone like that. His name is John. The first three answered the same questions. Where were they? What did Jesus say? But when John is interviewed, what does John say about that event? He says, there was reclining on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. So when he had dipped the morsel, he took it and gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. And after the morsel, Satan then entered into him. Therefore, Jesus said to him, "What you do, do quickly." Wait a minute. Hold on. This is an entirely new set of data. It is unique to John. Nobody else says that Satan entered Judas. What in the world? It appears that John isn't answering those questions. Where were they and what did Jesus say? John is adding data in two entirely new categories. Who was his favorite? That's the guy reclining on Jesus' bosom, right? The one who Jesus loved. And what did Judas, why did Judas do this? Because Satan entered into him. What is he? He's doing the exact thing I would expect a fourth witness who's aware of the first two witnesses would do. The accounts have the exact flavor of discrepancy I would see, not discrepancy, but of variation I would expect to see. And two, I also expect to see the fourth one who's aware of the first three to add data in new categories. This happens in every criminal trial you'll ever work, in every criminal investigation you'll ever work, and sure enough, it happens in the Gospels as well. And that's why as a new investigator of the Gospels, it never shook me that there were differences between the accounts. In fact, that was what gave me confidence that these look, at least on first glancing of view, these look like accounts I should investigate as potentially real accounts because these contain the exact level of variation I would expect to see. And the order of witnesses matters. John comes in later. He fills in a lot of details that are not in the Synoptic Gospels. Why would he do that? Because he was clearly aware of the Synoptic Gospels, and he's adding data the way you see every fourth witness add data. All right, I hope that kind of helps you to think about how you might process. Again, once you see the rules of evidence and see how evidence works and the experience you're going to have with eyewitness testimony or whatever it may be, it's a lot easier to communicate the claims to others because these issues that are up there to begin with, well, there's some differences between the accounts. Well, yeah, duh. This is what gives me confidence. We can not only address those issues, but we can turn them and show how they actually make a case for our position rather than a case against our position. Okay, that being said, I've got a call waiting on line one here. We're going to get to that right after this break. You're listening to the Stand to Reason radio show. I am Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kogel.
Do you have a friend, family member, or coworker who identifies as gay or lesbian? Or do you find yourself in conversations about the topic of homosexuality and want to make a productive contribution? Well, if you're either of these people, chances are you're wondering how to navigate those conversations and how to navigate those relationships in a healthy way, but without compromising your convictions. Well, I want to tell you about a new resource I've made called The Truth About Homosexuality, A Compassionate Response. And it's a DVD that includes the most comprehensive presentation of my teaching on this topic that I've ever presented. In this DVD resource, I'll present the truth about what Scripture and science says about this topic of homosexuality, but also show you how to communicate it in a persuasive yet winsome and gracious manner. So I hope you'll consider this resource to help you elevate your understanding of this topic and make your conversations with friends and family who identify as gay or lesbian to become more Christ-like.
Whether we realize it or not, everyone has a worldview. It's your set of beliefs about the way the world actually is. It's your picture of reality. And this belief system helps you answer the big questions of life. Where did I come from? What's wrong with the world? Is there a solution? Why am I here? So what you believe about the world determines how you live in the world. Your worldview has consequences. It will shape how you understand law, politics, race, gender, morality, and even science. That's why I'm excited to invite you to join me and a host of other speakers at this year's Rethink Apologetics Conference happening at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa on September 22nd and 23rd, 2017. Let's get equipped and rethink how you see the world by visiting rethinkapologetics.com and registering today.
Hello, friends. Jay Warner Wallace back here at Stand to Reason. And happy to continue our conversation about the most important and critical areas of life, ethics, values, and religion. I think we're going to get into a discussion of ethics and values here in line one with this is Irv, I believe. Let's see if I, Irv, how are you, buddy?
Fine. Thank you, Jim. Well, first of all, I wanted to compliment you for giving the audience cliff notes of rules of evidence and how,
exactly.
I guess, prospective jurors should be able to extrapolate what's expected in court or their responsibility. So it helps a lot. And then that now draws me into the question I have. I've done all that I could as far as investigating what I need to know, and here's the question to the quick. I've been studying a particular subject, and then I came across the situation or the incident involving John the Baptist,
right,
and Herod and Antipas and his wife Herodias.
Right.
And beyond the obvious are these circumstances that involve the law of Moses, and understandably, John the Baptist taking exception to their marriage status. The question came into my mind: what exactly was it? Because the scripture doesn't tell me what exactly was it that triggered John the Baptist to respond to them specifically about their marriage being in violation of what he understood.
Right. So the story basically is, and I'm trying to just pull up my my Bible here to kind of take a look at the actual passage itself. It's usually found, you can see it in a couple of different synoptics. It's in Matthew 14, the first part of Matthew 14. It's in the first, about the second part of Mark 6. It's in, even in Luke, I think it's in chapter 9. So you have this episode where Herod John is being thrown in prison for his views about Herod's marriage to Herodias, right? And so why would he, so I guess your question is, let's make sure I'm on the right same page with you. The question is, why would John be upset about this to begin with? Is that kind of where you're coming from?
No, I thought it would throw you. I'm going to try to give more clarity to it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. John the Baptist, understanding the scriptures at that time,
right,
the Old Testament, and leading mm-hmm. up to him baptizing our Lord, he understood, I mean, and the population, no doubt, because they had the high priest and the clergy of that day, instructing them in Moses' law. Jesus even reiterated that.
Right.
But here's where I have a problem, or not problem with John the Baptist, but a problem with the context of why he would zero in on them and call them out that, okay, your marriage is not legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know, what is God telling us about that situation? Because it ultimately led to John's death, unfortunately.
Right. Okay. So I think what and Melinda, the enforcer here, we were talking about this during the break, and so we've been kind of looking. I think we were kind of wondering where you were coming from, in the sense that one question is, why would, on the basis of only what he had available to himself in the Old Testament, why would he think this is such an atrocious thing? We have some more clear teaching on marriage in Paul's letters, from Jesus himself and in the Gospels. But at this point, we have John making this claim about Herod, and then Herod reacting the way he did and then imprisoning him. Well, I could see why John might make the claim to begin with. You do see in Levitical law, for example, in Leviticus 20, verse 21, that if a man takes his brother's wife, it is impurity. So what he's really expressing is the continuous, constant teaching of Scripture about taking the wife of another. Of course, the being the brother's wife, being a family member's wife, it seems to be in even another category that you'll see in Leviticus chapter 20. But the point I'm trying to make here is that he's simply expressing this notion that we see. It's not like it changes over time. It's just expressed differently over time, and Jesus will reiterate certain things. But the general notion here is that you don't take somebody else's wife, because then you've got an act of adultery occurring, right? Because she's betrothed to the other man, and both you and she are actually breaking that covenant, and that's why John takes the stand he is taking. And I think he could have taken that stand, because there's been some controversy. There's talk about whether Herod was truly Jewish, whether he was somebody who kind of married into
right.
Jewish people, whether he was somebody who took on cultural Judaism just for the sake of his political position. But it wouldn't really matter because I'm willing to make statements about what is right or wrong from God's perspective, even to people who would not call themselves followers of God or followers of Jesus. We're making a claim about what we think is more, is because again, what we're saying here is that these aren't subjective rules that are simply limited to people groups. What we're seeing here is a claim about marriage that is objective and transcends all people groups, if in fact it is coming from the objective transcendent source we call Yahweh. So in the end, I think it'd be entirely appropriate to make the claim, even if the hearer, Herod, doesn't share his religious worldview. Of course, if he does, then it's even more appropriate to make the claim, right? But even if he didn't, I think it'd be appropriate for him to say something. Now, how that's received, of course, is what why John is where he was.
Yes.
So,
and
does that help at all?
Go ahead. Partly, yes. And that's what I've been encountering, that, you know, it's just commonplace that as far as from the Christian community, that, you know, part based on Moses' law and then how Jesus expounds on it and the New Testament.
Yes.
But here's another factor.
Okay.
Not a factor, but a perspective.
Sure.
Herod Antipas and Herodias were in the limelight. They were in the public eye. So I'm thinking maybe that's what John wanted to emphasize to the crowd, the audience, that, hey, this is a bad marriage. Don't do as they do. That's why I started out, you know, with my question saying that we don't know any other components or aspects of that situation, but maybe that's what the point that John the Baptist was trying to make. It's totally mystified to me what was taking place as far as John the Baptist. What was he? How was he approaching it? What was his ultimate intended goal? As far as okay, I'm calling them out. They're in violation of Moses' law, but I'm calling them out just the same. And so I'm. Take a step back and say, maybe it's because, all right, today, all right, modern day, say, for instance, there's some celebrity, you know, in Hollywood, it's commonplace to divorce, remarry. Maybe in this case, John said, well, they're in the public eye, you know, they're like whatever celebrity you want to name out there, a couple, that is, and he's telling, you know, the crowds that this is wrong, this is illegitimate.
Right. Well, I think there's a good point you raised here. Number one, I think there's a history, right, a prophetic history of prophets from the Old Testament who typically will call out leadership, call out cultures.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be the most unpopular statements that could be made by anyone in a culture are probably going to come out of the mouths of a prophet. So it seems in some way that John is well within the tradition, right, the prophetic tradition of Old Testament prophets,
exactly.
Right? I mean, he's kind of doing the same thing, calling truth to power, right? So that this is what he does. But I do think it's interesting what you just said. About the role I think that people who are in the public eye do shoulder a bigger burden. And I only say that because, you know, so what do you do then if you are a public, let's say, athlete, and you're in our culture, and you're an athlete who's very popular, you're on some team that just won the championship, you know, football, just won the World Series, whatever it may be, whatever sport you're in, and you are an openly Christian public celebrity. Is there a burden? Do we have a burden? Is there a role model burden? I've heard a lot of athletes say, well, look, I'm not a role model. I'm just an athlete. Well, is anyone who's in the public eye, can they make that kind of a statement? You may not want to be a role model. You may not feel like you want that kind of limelight. But if you seek that position in culture or you just end up in that position in culture, I think you do carry an added burden, right? And so I think you can, if that's the case, I can certainly probably make a cultural statement faster by calling out the person that everyone knows in the culture than I could by calling out someone
right.
no one hears
right.
it, right? So in that sense, it might even be the best kind of targeted statement a prophet could make because and he was willing to die for his position of moral rightness. That to me is fascinating too. As a matter of fact, if he had called out his next door neighbor on this issue, would we even be talking about it today? No, we're talking about it because the king executed him. And now we want to know why that happened. And it turns out we're getting that story in Scripture. So if what he's trying to do is bring attention to this issue, he did it for the next 2,000 years by doing it with the person who he chose to do it with. So I think that's another fascinating. I'm not sure that's going to explain why he's doing it. I think he's just calling truth to power, speaking truth to power, as we see every prophet who precedes him. And we can see a basis for this in the Old Testament, why he would say it's wrong. We see the continuing basis for this in the New Testament. And I think that's probably a better explanation for why he does it. But, you know, I think these are both good things to think about, right? And fun things to think about. So I hope that helps a little bit as you kind of work through that yourself, Irv. And I appreciate your phone call. Thanks so much for calling Stand to Reason. All right,
thank
brother.
You too, Jay Warner.
Okay, talk to you soon. Now, that just brings up a couple of other issues, right? I mean, first of all, thank you to Melinda for quickly bailing me out with the Old Testament references, right? Because we kind of have a sense that if you're saying, wait, where in Levitical law is that statement made? Well, the first person who can operate their Bible gateway faster or just knows off the top of their head what verse that is going to be of great assistance. So I appreciate that. But I think in the end, there is no difference in terms of – it's not as though there's an absence about in terms of moral law related to marriage, and suddenly we have this higher moral standard in the New Testament. The standard of the New Testament is simply a reflection because nothing changes. It's just that now you have a chance to hear additional teaching from Jesus on the issue. And when Irv called and said, hey, you know, this kind of brief and quick summary of rules of evidence, I think those things are happy. And I want you to give me a call if we've got a little bit of time left in this hour before I have a special guest in about 20 minutes on a book that I think you're going to find fascinating. And if you are a digital native, you probably already – you may be involved and not even realize how the digital technology has changed your life because you're a digital native. And that means you're a Gen Z, you're somebody in that, you know, 3 to 8. But the rest of us, we're not digital natives. I'm 56. I'm what they would call a digital immigrant, you know. I came to this late. I came to this, I immigrated toward a digital, this whole life with pads and smartphones and all the rest of it. And so for us who are here coming to it late, it is interesting to see how this device, these devices, have impacted our lives. We're going to be talking about that at the top of the hour. All right, and until that, what we're going to do is take a short break, and when we come back, we will just do a few more rules of evidence, unless, of course, you call me with the question, at 855-243-9975. This is your last chance, probably, for today's show, at 855-243-9975. We'll be right back here at Stand to Reason Radio.
I have been working on one of the most important projects of my life for over a decade now, and it's finally come to press. It's called The Story of Reality, How the World Began, How It Ends, and Everything Important That Happens in Between. Now, The Story of Reality is a kind of a wide-angle view of the Christian story. It's a big-picture description of the meaning of the drama of human history. And it's meant to cover the basics of Christianity from a worldview perspective, in a voice that's really conversational, not religious. It's kind of a mere Christianity for a new generation, if that comparison doesn't seem too bold. Now, I tell the story using 5 words that capture the meaning of all of human history from its beginning to its end. God, man, Jesus, cross, and resurrection. The narrative, it's infused with what I call a kind of soft apologetics, that is thoughtful reflections that are not argumentative, but rather are friendly appeals to common sense notions we're all aware of that point to the truthfulness of the Christian story. I think you'll find The Story of Reality to be, as Lee Strobel put it, a beautifully crafted description of the Christian worldview written in an accessible, winsome, and well-reasoned manner.
Are you wondering where to get started as an ambassador for Christ? We've put together a fresh approach to help you grow in knowledge, wisdom, and character. Go to str.org, follow the Start Here link under Training. You'll find fun videos, informational resources, and key articles. The more you train, the better you can engage others with confidence, courage, and grace. Don't miss the quiz at the bottom of the page, where you can test the skills you've learned as an ambassador for Christ. Simply follow the Get Started link under the training section at the top of the webpage at str.org.
Glad you're still with us here. We are almost about two-thirds of the way through our first hour here at Stand to Reason, and I hope you are getting something out of this examination of simple biblical truths that we just talked about with Irv, and also of maybe some ways to improve your ability to communicate the case to others by simply mastering some simple rules of evidence and being able to train. Again, we don't just impanel jurors. We train the jurors on how to think, how to reason through evidential sequences, how to connect the dots so that they aren't just we're not just throwing facts on the wall. We're throwing facts on the wall and then training them what relevance these facts might have and how to assess whether a witness is reliable. All of these are part of the jury instruction. We actually give jurors a set of instructions that it helps them to assess whether a witness is reliable. And one of the things we instruct, and let me just continue, this is the fifth of several rules of evidence I've been trying to share with you today. One of the things we instruct jurors is that a witness can be wrong, yet still be determined reliable. And I know that that is maybe counterintuitive, right? There's a sense, there's a, almost a feeling that, hey, if a witness is wrong about something, you just can't trust them. The first time I find an error, that witness is disqualified. And that's not actually the case. A witness can be wrong about a particular fact, and you could still trust her on or him on other facts. And this happens all the time. I've had cases, and one of my very first cold cases that I have ever worked was a case that at some point in the jury trial hinged on the testimony of an eyewitness. And we asked this eyewitness if the door, she was somebody who had traded shifts with a victim at a fast food restaurant. She wanted the night off so she could date a young man who ultimately she ended up marrying, but she wanted to have a date with this young man, and so she asked her coworker to cover her shift. And the coworker said, yeah, I can do that for you. And so they swapped shifts, and it was on that shift that was swapped that the coworker, the victim, was ultimately killed. The killer came in that night, came in through the back door of the business, and murdered the victim. And the next morning, the girl who had traded shifts came in to start the next day shift. And when she got there, the car in the parking lot from her friend, who was supposed to be gone, was still in the parking lot because she didn't realize at the time her friend was already dead inside the business. But the minute she saw the car, she panicked. She had that kind of hair on the back of your neck stand up, that kind of intuitive sense that this isn't good. Something is wrong. She raced to the door. She opened the door, she walked in, and sure enough, she discovered her good friend on the floor of the business. Now, the question in trial that was critical at some point was, okay, tell me, let's call this girl Karen. Karen, when you came in and you saw the car on the driveway, okay, then you went to the business, right? Yes. And you walked in the back door to see if the victim was in the business. Yes. And just think about it. Tell me, was the back door to the business locked or unlocked? Locked or unlocked? And she thought about it, and she couldn't remember. Not only that, she hazarded a guess, which you'd never want someone to do right on the stand. And she offered an answer that was the wrong answer. So she not only couldn't remember, she got it wrong. She guessed wrong. Now, of course, the defense attorney at the point of arguing this at the very end of the case really wanted the jury to discount and disregard this witness because, after all, she had been wrong about the door being locked. And so he argued that you shouldn't trust her at all. She's not reliable. She can't be trusted. She's wrong about a very important fact. As a matter of fact, the issue was this guy who did the murder a coworker? Did he have a key to get in? Would the victim have let him in? If the victim would have let him in, would she let in a stranger? She's not the kind of person who would let in a stranger. So it turned out whether or not that door was locked was key. And this witness got it wrong. And so the defense attorney said, you can't trust anything else she's told you about this. How do we know where else she might be wrong? Now, the jury, in the end, said, no, we find her to be reliable. She's wrong about that, but we get that. But we're going to trust her on everything else that she has offered in this trial. Well, why would they do that? Because they had already been instructed by the judge about this issue. Again, Jury instructions. You have to learn the rules of evidence. You have to understand how evidence is processed if you want to come to an accurate conclusion. It turns out a witness can be mistaken about a particular detail, yet still be considered reliable. This is what the jury instruction sounds like in the state of California. Again, it's from the Judicial Council of California's criminal jury instructions. It's section 105. Do not automatically reject testimony just because of inconsistencies or conflicts. Consider whether the differences are important or not, number one. And two, people sometimes honestly forget things or make mistakes about what they remember. Also, two people may witness the same event yet see or hear it differently. That's a jury instruction. That's an instruction we give jurors when they're assessing two witnesses that appear to contradict one another. It's to help them understand that they might even appear to contradict each other, yet both be reliable and trustworthy. Now, I am not suggesting that there's anything wrong or factually inaccurate in the Scripture, in any of the Gospels. But just for the thought experiment, even if there was an error, that would not alone allow you to discount or disqualify a gospel and consider it unreliable, at least not the way we evaluate witnesses in criminal trials, because we have to ask the question, why might Karen have missed this? Why might Karen be wrong about that? Well, because she panicked the minute she saw the car in the parking lot. She wasn't thinking from that point on. She was on a mission to make sure her friend was okay. She doesn't remember anything that occurred between the car and the victim's body. So I'm now going to understand why she might not see this, why she might not get this, why she might omit it, why she might not be paying attention to it. When you're looking at the Gospels, ask yourself, if you think something's missing here that somebody else covers, why might he have missed it or intentionally left it out? Remember, people see things differently. It doesn't mean that either one is lying. They just see it differently based on their dispositions, the things they're interested in, the things they aren't interested in, or maybe some point they're trying to make, or maybe they were in a different geography related to the event, their different location. And so these reports might sound different when in fact they are both telling you the truth. Jury instructions help us to assess how we evaluate evidence. Now, of course, there's another way to evaluate evidence on this cumulative basis. Let me give you another jury instruction, another rule. And that's simply this: the more cumulative the case, the stronger the inference. Duh, right? I mean, that's not hard to understand, okay? That when I have eight pieces of evidence that point to the same conclusion, that's better than two pieces of evidence. But I want to show you a little trick here. It turns out that when you build a cumulative case, it helps you to evaluate odd pieces of evidence that seem like they're open to more interpretation. Here's what I mean. Let's say I've got nine pieces of evidence, all that point to Joe as the murderer. The 10th piece of evidence, though, it could point to Joe. I mean, I can interpret it as Joe being guilty and causing this, or I might be able to interpret that 10th piece as being caused by somebody else. In other words, the 10th piece is not as clear as the other nine. So the question will always be, and defense attorneys want us to camp on that 10th piece, right? That 10th piece is not quite so certain. Well, how would I interpret the 10th piece? I allow the nine pieces that do convincingly point to him help me to understand how to interpret the 10th piece that seems to be on the fence. Does that make sense? In a cumulative case, you allow the majority of clear pieces of evidence to interpret the one that might be a fence setter. Same thing is true in Scripture, right? People will constantly argue that there's some verse of Scripture that seems to be contrary to the clear teaching of Scripture, or to cast some doubt, or I want to build an entire theological system on one verse. Well, how do we evaluate verses that might be rather tentative or sit on the fence? Well, we do it by allowing the verses that are clear to dictate how we interpret the one verse that seems to be vague. The same way we do in criminal trials. So collect your list of evidences. Collect your list of verses when making a case. What's the role of marriage in adultery or divorce in marriage? Okay, we just had a phone call on that. We'll collect all the verses that deal with this issue and make a list. And if you think you've got an unclear verse, I get that. But you've got 10 verses that are clear. Allow the 10 clear verses to interpret the one rather than make or force the one to interpret the 10. It's not, to mix a metaphor, it's not rocket surgery, okay? It's relatively clear in criminal trials. I think when you see it, how we do it in criminal trials, it'll make it easier for you to communicate it when you're arguing with somebody who has developed an entire theological system on one verse or wants to claim that one verse in isolation destroys your case. No, vague verses are interpreted through the lens of clear verses. Let me offer another way of thinking about this as well, because we talked earlier about the standard of proof being beyond a reasonable doubt. And that really bugs some people because they feel like, well, it sounds like you're saying, Jim, that this is all about probabilities. Like it's more probable than not that he did it. How could you ever convict somebody on that lame standard of proof? Oh, it's more probable than not that God exists. Really? That's not enough. That doesn't satisfy me. I'd have to have clear ways of evaluating the level of probability. It would have to be incredibly high. I'd have to have a formula in place. You know, something like the likelihood principle of confirmation theory or the odds form of Bayesian theorems. Really? Could you imagine? I mean, imagine the complexity of those theorems. Do you think when we do a jury trial, we say, okay, folks, you've seen 100 pieces of evidence now. So now when you go back and deliberate about this, I'm going to draw the formula on the whiteboard. And here I start penciling out four lines of, you know, propositions and hypotheses and how to evaluate those. No, we don't do that. We do have a jury instruction for jurors when we've offered them 100 pieces of evidence. Do you know what it is? It's pretty tough. Here it is. We say, use your common sense. That's it. That's all we and by the way, that is a rule of evidence I want to present to you next. Your common sense is sufficient. It is. We have jury's instructions for this. But just imagine a scenario. Okay, here's your scenario. Your friend comes into work the next day, tomorrow, and she says, oh, you know what? My son is a good kid, but last night, he took off like around 7 o'clock. He didn't come back until like 2 in the morning, and he overslept today, didn't get out of bed till 11 o'clock. I was kind of suspicious, so this morning I went out and I saw that his car was kind of parked sideways on the curb. It was like it wasn't parked straight. And then by the driver's door on the ground, do you know what I discovered? I discovered a receipt. Yeah, crumpled up to a local liquor store. And on the receipt, whoever had that receipt, it had like a bottle of whiskey on it. So I'm waiting around for my kid to get up, and he finally gets out of bed. You should see him. He looked like death warmed over. He looked like he was in terrible shape. And the shirt that he was wearing the night before, he had slept in it. He was still in the same clothes he left in yesterday. And the only difference is he had either like spilled something on his shirt. It was all stained. It smelled like alcohol. And he walked over, okay, to the cupboard, and he opened the door. And without even saying anything, he just grabbed aspirin and started taking aspirin. I don't know how to. I don't know what to think. What do you think? Now that your friend's asking you this, okay? After describing this scenario, giving these what 6-7 pieces of evidence, do you think you're now going to get on a whiteboard and chalk out the Bayesian theorem, the formula involving properties of evidence and hypotheses and how to evaluate? No, you're not going to do that. You're going to say, "Girl, use your common sense. Your son's out drinking last night. This is not rocket surgery." This is pretty obvious because your common sense is actually sufficient in these kinds of cases in evaluating pieces of evidence. As a matter of fact, we have jury instructions that say in deciding whether testimony is true, guess what? Use your common sense. Use your common experience. Oh, in deciding whether a factual question related to force is true, oh, use your common sense. Over and over and over again, juries are told, even in the most critical cases, where someone's life is on the line, capital offense cases, death penalty cases, the theorem that's in place is simply your common sense. So when someone says you need a certain level of certainty and some kind of formula to figure out what the probability is, remind them that that's really not the case because you don't do that in anything else in your life. You don't require that level of certainty or that formulaic approach to truth in any other aspect of your life. That is something you're just elevating a standard for a particular reason here. I suspect it's because you don't like the conclusion when it comes to God's existence, right? Let me give you another quick before we break for the hour. And that is that evidence, the more diverse it is in a cumulative case, the better and more reasonable the inference. Here's what I mean. It's not just that I have 8 pieces of evidence that point to this guy. Is that the 8 pieces of evidence are in different kinds of categories. So, for example, what did a case, most of my cases, they're going to involve usually some direct eyewitnesses, but maybe some eyewitnesses that saw certain behaviors but didn't actually see the crime. I'm also going to have some behavioral evidence, things that were reported about what he did. I'm going to have usually some forensic physical evidence in my cases. I'm even going to have some statements that are made by the defendant. In other words, I've got 4 very different categories of evidence, And these experts I call are entirely different areas of expertise. They know nothing about each other's areas of expertise, and they all point to the same reasonable inference. Well, how in the world? That's a good inference. If they all point to the same guy, all these different sciences, these different disciplines, you probably got the right guy. Well, it turns out that a case could be made for God's existence from eight pieces of evidence I described earlier in this hour in the universe. The origin of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe. Well, those two are cosmological evidences. Those require astrophysicists and physicists to give you as expert testimony to try to sort those out. Two, the origin of life and the appearance of design and biology are biological evidences. These are very different kinds of experts. These don't know anything about astrophysics. They are biochemists. They are people who are in the biological sciences. Two, consciousness and free agency are the area of neuroscience and philosophy, the problem of mind. Very different experts. They know nothing about astrophysics, nothing about biochemistry. And two are moral, you know, the objective transcendent moral truths and the standard for good by which we judge anything as evil. Those things are absolutely different disciplines. And if all four were to point to the exact same causal explanation, probably a good inference. And I think, and as I wrote in God's Crime Scene, that's exactly what happens. I think that you have four entirely different categories of evidence, very diverse, different disciplines, all of which have a common explanation. So tell me, I've got one last opportunity before I leave you for this hour, and we've got our guest waiting online already, which I'm really looking forward to talking to him. We have one more thing I want to cover quickly. There is a difference, and hear me, there's a difference between facts and inferences. I hear this all the time. They are confused. Oh, the fact of evolution. Okay, evolution is not a fact. Evolution is an inference. Now, it might be true, but it's not a fact. Facts are the data from which we draw inferences. In a crime scene, we have facts, the data, the evidence in the scene. We were going to draw an inference about how that evidence is best explained. So when you say, and by the way, a lot goes into that. If you don't understand the rules of evidence I've just been talking about, you can draw an improper inference, even though you all agree on the facts. But your personal desires, your likes, your dislikes, your passions, the way you're wired, this stuff impacts your decision-making process. You can come to a different inference about the same set of facts just based on your biases. So don't confuse these two things. We start in the same location. We might collect the same number of the same exact same facts. In every criminal trial I do, I present 100 pieces of evidence. The defense attorney does not come up to the stand and produce another different set of evidences. He simply uses my evidence. He says, and he gets an expert to give you a different inference. Folks, your inferences may vary. They are different than the facts. There's a difference. I hope as we've talked about these rules of evidence, it's helped you to understand that understanding the rules helps you to make the case. Now, in the next hour, I've got a guest that I think is going to help you understand why your life has been changed in just the last decade by the device you're holding at the end of your arm. We'll do that right after the break. I'll see you in the next hour here at Stand to Reason.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.